just order. Visit democracynow.org to see our interviews with Trump's niece, Mary, and nephew, Fred. Happy birthday to Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Applications for Cohort 10 of the Pathy Foundation Fellowship are now open. The Pathy Foundation Fellowship is an intensive, 12-month experiential learning opportunity for graduating students to lead a self-directed project in a community they have a meaningful connection with. Fellows are provided with comprehensive training, personal and professional development coaching, $40,000 in funding, and wraparound supports to design, plan, and implement an innovative project in their community. Submit your application today at www.pathyfellowship.com.
My name is Lauren Heisey, and this is Redomancy. They marry on a Sunday evening, with no witnesses but the birds in the trees and the stars in the sky. The valley is quiet. A soft summer breeze ruffles the leaves of the willow tree the pair has found shelter under. The brook murmurs behind them as they sit face to face. The last few rays of the dying sun cast the field in shades of gold, turning the flowers to jewels and setting the water on fire. A patina of peace has settled over their little sanctuary, enveloping the birds and the trees and the brook and the bees in a soft, motherly embrace. They will not be disturbed here. One of the two, Florian, though this is not the name they were born with, the name their mother gave them, the name that means long hair and swishing skirts and skin that doesn't fit quite right, tips their head back and runs their hands through the tall grass, collecting the dew on their fingertips. The breeze tousles their hair, cut short with dull kitchen shears in the middle of the night, how their mother screamed when she saw, and they breathe in the sweet scent of honeysuckle dappled with moss and fresh dirt. They want to live in this moment forever, to dig their fingers into the earth and let the flowers sprout amongst their bones, here where they are Florian. Florian and no one else. The other, Merle, though this is not the name they were born with, the name their father gave them, the name that means marrying well and staying home to look after the children and flinching at every reflection, gives Florian an infectious smile that breaks them in two, like they know each and every one of their thoughts. Their own hair hangs down by their shoulders, free from the leather cord they often use to keep it out of their eyes while working in the smithy with their father. Merle's eyes sparkle with unrestrained glee as their bare toes dig into the soil, their skin smudged with dirt. Florian calls to mind the roots of the willow they are sitting underneath, stretching down, 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 a firm, unfailing foundation. Florian has never wanted anyone more. They reach forward, taking both of Merle's hands in their own. As their fingers intertwine, it's almost as if something fits back into place in their chest, something that had always been just slightly dislocated. This day has been a long time coming, from the very first day they met, when Florian had looked across the busy market square to lock eyes with the blacksmith's only child, wearing boys' pants and reenacting a tale of knights and dragons to some of the local children. "Are you ready?" Merle asks, their voice hushed, their eyes alight with mirth. This moment is clandestine, and the pair are giddy with the feeling, with the knowledge that nothing can touch this, nothing can stop this. Florian could grow wings and take to the sky just because they are here, because they are free. "I'm ready." The words are sweet, bursting on their tongue as if they'd bitten into a fresh strawberry. They tighten their grip on Merle's hands. In the end, they exchange few words. Both know the love in their hearts to be true and reciprocated. Anything they could say fails in comparison to this, this beautiful, holy love they have found in each other. Florian isn't sure when they both started crying, but when Merle takes their face in their warm, rough palms and kisses them like they never want to let go, they decide it doesn't quite matter. They're more focused on the feel of Merle under their hands, the cut of their tunic, the fall of their hair, the beat of their heart. They lie together then, the birds and the trees and the brook and the bees as their witnesses. The sun has set, bathing them in starlight and moon dust, the night sparkling with pearl and silver. The soft summer wind blows around them, the majesty of the earth singing the pair a soft, motherly tune. If only they could root themselves into the very soil, into the rocks and the roots of the great willow they lie underneath, cementing themselves here for all eternity, safe from all harm. If only they could grow as tall as the trees, standing as a monument to those before and those who will come after, to say that they are here. We lived, their hearts beat. We lived, and we live, and this cannot be taken away.
Listening to Close Reads on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Madeline. On Close Reads, we share and analyze creative writing by students here at Queens. Tune in for Close Reads from Close By. Today, we'll be talking about Redomancy by Lauren Heisey, which you just heard, which was followed by Cartwheel by Lucy Dacus. Redomancy was published in the 2023 quilt mini, The Sublime.
Lauren Heisey is a fourth-year student majoring in English and minoring in drama. Their work primarily focuses on the queer and trans experience and has been published in the Quilt Literary Magazine. When they aren't writing, Lauren is an avid performer and musician and serves as music director of Queen's University Chorus.
I'd like to start by talking about language and the way it's undercut in this story. For both characters, we meet them and learn their names and then learn that this is not the name they were born with. So pretty immediately in the story, the narration foregrounds the fact that one's assigned name can be insufficient or inaccurate to describe them. We encounter this insufficiency of language as a queer experience, but also as a very charged introduction to a story that makes itself understood through language. If language is not enough, what does it mean for this story that language is all it has to speak to us? As we approach the answer to that question, the story presents language to us as a sensory experience rather than just a textual one. Florian says they're ready, and then the narration tells us that the words are sweet, bursting on their tongue as if they've bitten into a fresh strawberry. Compared to the brief words, "I'm ready," the description of the words as a fresh strawberry, sweet, and bursting on their tongue is incredibly lush imagery. The narration prioritizes Florian's embodied experience of saying the words, and the description takes up much more space on the page than the speech act. The imagery communicates a sensory anticipation for the taste it describes. I, at least, can't help but feel a little hungry for strawberries whenever I read it, so that we move beyond the sentiment of being ready to a much more concrete image of anticipation. The passage then ends with Florian tightening their grip on Merle's hands, an act of communication between the two of them solely through body language. The body is really eclipsing language by this point in the story. When we get to the marriage ceremony, we don't even hear the words they say to each other. The narrator simply tells us that in the end, they exchange few words. Anything they could say fails in comparison to this. This description highlights the inadequacy of language, or maybe the lack of language to describe a queer experience beyond what the characters have the capacity or language to talk about. The queer love between them is identified as holy, so their inability to talk about it is suggested to be because the experience is too spiritual to be articulated. Not because it never happened, but because it was too much to talk about. The lack of language is because of an excess rather than a deficiency. The story ends on another note of body language. We lived, their hearts beat. Here, the lack of language parallels the idea of unwritten queer histories. We can expand that lack of language into a lack of histories, a lack of archives or precedents, or ways to understand their experience. But still, they lived, and their embodied presence, the beating of their hearts, is more important than whether they have language to record that presence. The beating is record enough. Finally, I'll note that the title Rhetomancy is Latin for requited or mutual love. So the story's focus on reciprocal love itself serves as a definition or expansion of its title. Most of us don't read Latin, so the title is likely insufficient in communicating the story's themes to us, but then we read the story, and that experience gives us an understanding that the simple text of the title did not. So the story does answer the question of what happens when language is not enough, by making language a tool of experience, reversing the usual subordination of the body as a tool of language.
The story also resists ideas about traditional relationships. Obviously, we have this private queer marriage, but there are also interesting things happening with regards to family. First, the speaker personifies the natural environment, as they marry with no witnesses but the birds and the trees and the stars in the sky, and the brook murmurs behind them as they sit face to face. We also have this patina of peace which settles over the sanctuary, enveloping the birds and the trees and the brook and the bees in a soft, motherly embrace. So we get this imagery of the surroundings, which is very vivid and really makes you feel like you're there, but we also get a development of the environment as a character or multiple characters. The birds, trees, brook, and bees attend the wedding in place of relatives, which you would normally expect to be at this kind of wedding. And in addition to personifying the environment, this creates a familiar relationship between Florian, Merle, and the beings and features of their surroundings. The sense of connection with the environment is immediately followed by a paragraph about Florian's mother screaming at their haircut, and we also know that this is a reaction to their queerness. The juxtaposition between this and the comfort and freedom that the protagonists find in the forest resists this idea that like love and even family must come from blood relatives. Instead, the soft motherly embrace comes from the environment when it is lacking from this like nuclear family structure. References to biological family and human community do come up a few times in the middle section of the story. In addition to the explicit mentions of Florian's mother and Merle's father, we learn that Florian and Merle will not be disturbed here and that they are safe from all harm, which implies that there is harm that would come to them from people beyond the forest. However, as the story comes to a close, our focus returns to another maternal figure in nature as Soft Summer Wind sings the pair a soft motherly tune. Here we have a repetition of the maternal care, but also of softness and comfort that this care gives. The outside world is not present in the beginning and end of the story, centering Florian and Merle's relationship with each other, but also with the natural environment. The only exception to this, of course, is the message to those who will come after to say that they are here. As Madeline described, the section gets at that idea of unwritten queer histories, as the characters reach forward in time while we as the readers know that the author is reaching back in time while writing them. The relationship that closes the story is therefore this relationship with other queer people, with one another and with the author and with readers and those who will come after. This kind of gets at ideas of like found family and finding kinship with other queer people when one's family isn't able to offer that.
Next, we'll be playing Maps by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, followed by an interview with Lauren.
Thank you.
now I'm sitting down with Lauren Heise to talk about Rhetomancy. Lauren, my first question for you is about the setting of the piece. The story hints at being set in a time much before ours. So I wanted to ask, why did you decide to set the story in the past?
So this question requires a little bit of backstory. I had ENGL321 with Dr. Straker, shout out, last year. And during one of the lectures, we covered the circumstances surrounding marriage in the medieval period. Essentially, if you weren't a member of the aristocracy, you could marry someone if you got verbal consent from them and then consummated it. And I was sitting in this class and I had this huge like aha moment, because can you imagine what that would mean for you if you were a queer person? You wouldn't need permission from anyone to be who you were. And that's really what I wanted to get at. Apart from that, I also just have a huge interest in the medieval and early modern periods, particularly in the ways we see queerness in those times. To have people just like me in a space I find a lot of comfort in was really mostly an exercise and indulgence on my part.
That's really awesome. And thank you for that exercise and indulgence, because it's a really lovely piece to read. So speaking of, I guess, places that queer people can find solace in, the natural setting is very present and even really animate in this story. Can you talk to me about the role of nature in this piece?
Absolutely. So I think that nature is essential to this piece. I don't think it would be the same or even kind of work as it is without it. And I think that's for two reasons. For one, if you're queer, most likely you've heard more than once in some kind of way that you're unnatural, that your very body and soul just shouldn't exist. And I really hope that that isn't the case for you if you're queer, but unfortunately is the case for a lot of us. It's a sentiment that can be incredibly damaging, especially to younger queer folks, and has been to me personally. So I wanted the nature in Rhetomancy to stand as kind of an antithesis to that idea. The earth that cradles Florian and Merle in this one moment never suggests that anything they're doing is wrong. And in fact, she supports and encourages their union. And then the second, on a lighter, less existential note, I guess, is that the piece started with nature when I was writing it. I love imagery and find that if I'm grounded in a scene that I'm writing, then I can see where it's supposed to go. And then hopefully my readers can then be grounded too.
That's awesome. So I'm going to pivot a little bit to talk about, this is quite similar to what we were discussing, because I want to talk about English class. So the story is very unconventional in many ways, especially, you know, sort of inserting the sort of queer presence that isn't necessarily recorded, even if it was there, as you were talking about. But it does draw on existing elements of literary canon. And specifically, I'm thinking of English poet John Donne's poem, The Ecstasy, which we also read in that class, in which two lovers are elevated out of their physical bodies to a sort of spiritual communion enabled by their physical closeness. Do you see this story as like writing to or maybe against the literary canon? Like, what is its role in relation to the literature that we already have representing this period?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I answer this question, I just need to point out that I am a John Donne hater. Folks who are listening who know me know that the fact that you're asking me this question is like so painful to me, but it's also like a really good question, and I did spend a lot of time thinking about it, so sorry to my John Donne lovers out there, Dr. Straker. So I have a bit of a cop-out answer for it, but I have a reason, and I brought evidence. So I think that Rhetomancy calls back to the literary canon because I wrote it as a queer person interested in queerness in the medieval and early modern period. But it also diverts from it and goes against it. So it's kind of ended up in a bit of a liminal space. So when I say this, I'm thinking of theorists like Nadia Ellis and Jose Munoz, who say that queerness is a space located in the in-between. So if we find the queer experience in a place that is neither here nor there, then that can open up a lot of space for new conversations and possibilities, which is what I wanted for Rhetomancy. So for example, we see queerness in the literary canon of the medieval and early modern era that often isn't always explicit and can be refuted and has been. I was thinking medieval when I specifically wrote this, but since you mentioned Donne, who is early modern, I figured I could reference Shakespeare's Fair Youth sonnet sequence, many of the Richard Barnfield sonnets. But if you want like a specific one, you can check out Sonnet 16. And then my love, Christopher Marlowe's Edward II. there is precedence for queerness in these pieces and kind of the literary canon that I'm working around, but my piece was meant to make that very obvious. I'd also argue that most of the queerness we see in the existing literary canon of the period is particularly tragic. If you look at the examples that I cited, they don't end happily. We usually see some kind of tragedy of love, whether it be unrequited, betrayed, or cut short by death, unfortunately. And I went in with the intention of writing something that is, one, irrefutably queer, and two, and more importantly, joyful. I think that writing in a little liminal space was useful for that and hopefully resonates with a lot of other queer people who may see themselves in my writing or want to see themselves in this time period.
That's so wonderful. Lauren, thank you so much. Thank you for citing your sources. Thank you for the reading list. Definitely we'll have to write that down and check some of those out. And thank you for coming in. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You can read Redomancy by Lauren Heisey on the Quilt website at queensquilt.ca. This has been Close Reads with Corey and Madeline on CFRC 101.9 FM. To take us out, we'll have Moon Meets Sun by Palmer St. Clair.
smile from morning to the night. The perfect poster child that was once in my life. A door made out of glass. All her friends think that she's great, but I can see through it all and she's about to break. Remember last year when you told me to always stay here, never leave me. The light from your eyes made me feel like we were dancing in the moonlight. Remember last year when you told me these will be lifelong stories. The light from your eyes made me feel like we were dancing in the moonlight. Forgets a smile, never gets a break from this life in denial. A door made out of glass, all her friends think that she's great, but I can see through it all and she's about to break. Oh, I remember last year when you told me to always stay here, never leave me. The light from your eyes made me feel like we
host Chris for The Witching Hour live on CFRC 101.9 FM every Wednesday at 12 a.m., where you can get your weekly dose of metalcore, post-hardcore, crying, screaming, and sometimes throwing up.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
They say nothing good happens after midnight, but why not stay a while and find out?
Hey, what's up, guys? My name is May, aka DJ Mayhem, and I'll be hosting The Mood with May here on CFRC 101.9 FM every Wednesday from 11 until noon. Tune in weekly to hear me explore music and artists across genres and decades, curated around a different vibe or category each time. Whether you love finding new music just like me, or you want to switch it up a bit, I'll have plenty to offer. Follow me on Instagram at The Mood with May for updates and more information, or my show page on CFRC.ca.
We are just like every other human being in that some of us are wonderful, some of us are schmucks. But beyond that, we are gay human beings, and we have lived a different perspective on gender, on sex, on relationships.
What's really beautiful about being able to tour the world is I get to meet people who are inspired by her work in the 80s and 90s, and will come up to me after the show and say, she was the first lesbian I ever saw who loved herself out loud.
And her name is Iverson Vaughn!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The European Union's top court orders interstate recognition of legal gender changes, the Anglican Church of Southern Africa rejects queer couple blessings, and writer-performer Alok Vad Menon reflects on the legacy of their aunt, Irvishi. their stories and more this week now that you found This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Marcos Najera.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 5th, 2024. All 27 European Union member states must recognize a person's legal gender transition secured in any other member state by order of the European Court of Justice. In a landmark October 4th ruling, the EU's highest court wrote, "Gender, like a first name, is a fundamental element of personal identity." Ariane Mizrafi-Ahi holds dual British and Romanian citizenship. His Romanian birth certificate registered him as female. He migrated to Britain in 2020 while it was still an EU member. There, he was able to transition and change his legal gender to male. Under Romanian law, his application to change the gender marker on his birth certificate and government ID was rejected. Every citizen in Romania must be able to provide their government ID for routine things like managing a bank account, picking up mail at a post office, and using public transportation. In the court's view, a divergence between identities resulting from such a refusal of recognition creates difficulties for a person in proving his or her identity in daily life, as well as serious professional, administrative, and private inconvenience. Transgender people can now travel to any EU member state for business or pleasure and have their legal gender respected, even if the national laws of a specific member state like Romania do not. Plaintiff Ariane Mizrafi-Ahi is now a science tutor living in Cambridge. He celebrated by video link with a gathering of his supporters in Bucharest. He said, "I cried, really. It was indeed a victory that we have been waiting for many years."
Georgia's President Salome Zurabishvili refused to sign the Protection of Family Values and Minors Law. But after several days of high drama, Parliament Speaker Shalva Papuashvili has wielded the pen. Zurabishvili is not a fan of Papuashvili's ruling Georgian Dream Party's governance and strongly opposed the legislation. The politically powerful Georgian Orthodox Church backs the party in the socially conservative Eastern European nation. Mirroring similar no-promo-homo legislation in neighboring Russia, the bill outlaws public displays of support for LGBTQ people. Pride events and representation in all forms of media are prohibited, even displaying rainbow flags. The law denies gender-affirming healthcare and the ability to change legal gender. It rejects civil marriage and adoption rights for same-gender couples. Papuashvili expects international criticism of the law, he says, does not reflect current, temporary, changing ideas and ideologies. His Facebook post says the law is based on common sense, historical experience, and centuries-old Christian, Georgian, and European values. He told RFERL, "We saw the currents of civilization were going in the wrong direction." Several Georgian and international human rights groups have denounced the legislation. They call the country's seeming drift toward Vladimir Putin's Russia an obstacle to its European Union aspirations. However, all politics is local, and the Dream Party's immediate goal is domestic, stoking homo and transphobia ahead of national elections in late October. As Tbilisi Pride activist Anna Tavadze told the Associated Press, "Georgian Dream's aim is to fabricate problems ahead of the election to distract people from their failure to solve issues involving unemployment, education, and healthcare."
Gay Chechen men are reportedly being forced to fight in Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine. They are threatened with trumped-up criminal charges and forced to enlist if they can't afford to pay what is essentially a huge bribe, according to the Chechen human rights group SKSOS. Chechen's Putin puppet Ramzan Kadyrov often claims that there are no gay people in the predominantly Muslim Russian region. In reality, he has led a well-documented purge of queer people for the past several years under his semi-autonomous rule. The SKSOS noted an increasing wave of detentions of gay men in Chechnya in August of this year. Authorities use gay dating apps to entrap and jail them. They then use those men's social media and dating app accounts to entrap other gay men. The rights group says that at least 7 Chechen gays have been forced to fight on the front lines in Ukraine. One of them has already been killed in battle.
The Anglican Church of Southern Africa has rejected a proposal to allow bishops to approve the giving of blessings to couples in same-sex unions, in the words of a provincial synod media statement. Clergy would have been able to decide based on their own consciences whether to bless or conduct marriage ceremonies for lesbian and gay couples. A show of hands vote on October 3rd quashed that proposal. Its proponents charged that the delegates failed to address the reality of sexual diversity in humanity in general. The synod also rejected a set of prayers for same-gender couples already in civil unions or civil partnerships. The South African LGBTQ rights group Inclusive and Affirming Ministries is lamenting the double loss. Their press release calls it a missed opportunity to move toward a more inclusive and compassionate expression of faith that further marginalizes individuals who seek nothing more than to live fully in the light of God's love. The Anglican Church of Southern Africa ministers to millions of the faithful in Eswatini, Lesotho, Namibia, St. Helena, and South Africa.
California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill this week to protect state-funded public libraries from book bans. The California Freedom to Read Act was sponsored by Democratic Assemblymember Al Marisochi of Torrance. He pointed to the escalating epidemic of bans on books with so-called woke themes, including those with queer, feminist, or racial content. Such purges usually come up in Republican-controlled states, but California has its conservative pockets. Murat Sochi's press statement proclaimed, "We need to fight this movement to ensure that Californians have access to books that offer diverse perspectives from people of all backgrounds, ideas, and beliefs." The measure takes effect on January 1st and applies only to state-funded public libraries. A similar bill covering public school libraries was signed by Newsom in September 2023. Under the law, the race, nationality, gender identity, sexual orientation, religion, disability, political affiliation, or any other characteristic may not be used to exclude books or other materials in public libraries. Access to such materials cannot be limited solely based on those criteria or the socioeconomic status of the writer or the perceived or intended audience. The state librarian will provide technical assistance to help jurisdictions develop local policies to comply with the legislation.
Finally, families attending an LGBTQ pride event in the southern Ohio town of Grove City were enjoying the food trucks, live music, pumpkin painting, and bracelet making for children. Then, about a dozen armed, masked Nazis showed up. Ohio is an open carry state that allows such firearms displays. The protesters waved swastika flags to demonstrate their displeasure on a nearby sidewalk cordoned off by police to prevent any direct confrontations. They chanted and yelled anti-LGBTQ epithets despite the presence of children. They made no overt threats of violence and left after about a half hour of failed intimidation. Mayor Ike Stage and the Grove City Council issued a joint statement condemning the display of hate. It read, in part, "We are a diverse community and want our citizens to feel welcome and safe. We stand with those affected and reaffirm our commitment to fostering an environment where all individuals can express themselves without fear or harassment." The September 28th festival was deemed the largest ever event in the area, which has a population of about 42,000. Nathan Stover said the Nazis had no impact on the celebration. He told local ABC TV affiliate WSYX, "They can show up all they want, but it's not going to change the energy. Love has a greater energy than hate does."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending October 5th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay healthy.
And I'm Marcos Najera. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Make them laugh.
Comedy and humor are the best ways to move people, but there is nothing funny, nothing about oppression and prejudice. Hi, I'm Kate Clinton, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, reminding you that an informed community is a strong community.
Two unique LGBTQ plus voices are linked across a generation by archival recordings and a recent interview, proving that some of the best old things are new again. This Way Out's Brian DeShazer continues his one-of-a-kind exploration of a very special queer evolution.
Last week, we began our conversation with Alok Vadmenon, exploring their journey through their book Beyond the Gender Binary. This week, we conclude by focusing on their connection with their late aunt Urvashi Vad, a trailblazing activist whose birthday was October 8, 1958. We celebrate what would have been her 66th birthday. Through historic audio from This Way Out's archive, we'll reflect on Urvashi's impact on LGBTQ plus rights and her influence on Alok's path. If you missed part one,
a lot of the arguments that were used against gay and lesbian communities in the 50s and 60s are now being recycled against trans people.
Alok is an internationally acclaimed poet, comedian, performance artist, speaker, and actor known for their work on gender fluidity. With celebrated titles like Beyond the Gender Binary and Femin Public, they've made a global impact. You might recognize them from Hannah Gadsby's Gender Agenda on Netflix or the docu-short Alok, executive produced by Jodie Foster, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2024.
What I really try to always do in my shows is ask audiences, why am I only safe when I'm entertaining you? Why can't I look like this just next to you on the subway or walking down the street? Why do you see this as a costume and not what you're wearing as a costume? It's an attempt and a desire to disappear us so we can maintain the myth that there are just two genders, man and woman.
Urvashi Vad was a tireless advocate for LGBTQ plus rights and social justice, emerging as one of the most influential activists of her time. As a lawyer, writer, and organizer, she played a pivotal role in the fight for LGBTQ plus equality, HIV/AIDS awareness, and intersectional justice throughout the 1980s and 1990s. Her tenure as executive director of the National LGBTQ Task Force from 1989 to 1992, was groundbreaking, as she not only championed LGBTQ plus rights, but also expanded the movement to tackle issues of race, gender, and economic inequality. Urvashi's ability to connect different movements, showing how LGBTQ plus equality is intertwined with broader struggles for justice, remains one of her most enduring contributions. Her work laid the foundation for the inclusive approach many activists embrace today. Let's take a listen to one of her powerful moments from our archives, where she shares her vision and passion for creating a world where everyone is truly free.
Questions that those folks were asking in the original statement of purpose of the Mattachine Society are still relevant today. What are we for? was one of their biggest questions. They wanted to create an organization, a movement of gay and lesbian people who asked themselves, what do we represent? What difference do we represent to the world? And that, you know, they were asking this question in 1950, and it's still relevant today. I think that gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender people need to ask ourselves, what kind of vision of justice and society and economics can we bring to the table out of our own experience of being sexual minorities, of being different in that way? I mean, we are human beings, and we are just like every other human being in that. Some of us are wonderful. Some of us are schmucks. Some of us are wealthy. Some of us are poor. We are human beings, and we encompass the full spectrum of human diversity. But beyond that, we are gay human beings, and we have lived a different perspective. We have a different perspective on gender, on family, on sex, on relationships. And perhaps we have a different perspective on power, on governance, on decision making. And we have yet as a movement to articulate those differences.
Well, I get actually really emotional listening to her because of the time she was in. That was 1995. And she's talking about gender politics. So I actually get very emotional listening to her.
Yeah, I get emotional too from a different reason. It's just like she spoke with so much security and self-conviction. It was often less about what she was saying and more about how she was saying it. And what's really beautiful about being able to tour the world is I get to meet people who were inspired by her work in the 80s and 90s. And what they'll say to me, they'll come up to me after the show and say, she was the first lesbian I ever saw who loved herself out loud. And that gave me permission to love myself. I didn't think that that was possible. She had so much sense of rootedness. And I think that was very threatening for people because the society profits off of LGBTQ people doubting ourselves, hating ourselves, feeling insecure, so that we grovel and we don't actually fight for more total and fundamental freedom.
Right. So self-loathing character of all of us, right?
And that's how divisions within our own communities become manipulated. I see a lot of the transphobia within the LGBTQ community is internalized homophobia from a lot of gay men, especially. I get a lot of feedback from an older generation of gay men who say, this is not what we fought for. You're embarrassing. Why are you dressed like that? You look like a clown. And I read that as a confession. Oh, someone bullied you because you were too effeminate. I'm so sorry that you weren't allowed to express your femininity. I think it's powerful and beautiful. And so what I really also take from Orbitsch's legacy is not just her political diagnosis of what was wrong, but also her conviction in what was right. She genuinely believed that LGBTQ people were beautiful. And I don't think many people can say that. I think a lot of us still feel like our lives would have been better if we were straight or if we were cis. But for Orbitsch, she actually was so happy to be a lesbian. Being a lesbian was the greatest gift in her life, and she spoke about that until the very end. And what was so beautiful, I think, for me to have an elder lesbian in my life is I got to interface with her friend group and compare that to my parents and other straight adults in my life. And I was like, actually, being lesbian is the privilege because she has best friends who care about her, who are there to care for her when she's sick and dying, because they learn how to do that through HIV and AIDS, who can speak unflinchingly about death and grief and loss. There's so many skills that our community has that actually are skills that the entire world needs. And so I think that's why I get emotional when I hear her speak every time I do, is because think about the kind of self-work it took to have to be in 1995 and accept yourself so flagrantly.
Our next excerpt from This Way Out Archives was recorded on October 11th, 1987, and broadcast on This Way Out on April 26, 1994, and is introduced by Greg Gordon.
Here are a few of the many speakers and performers who inspired and entertained at a rally that lasted more than 7 hours following the start of the seemingly never-ending National March on Washington for lesbian, gay, and bi equal rights and liberation.
She's a rabble-rouser that you know as well as I know. She's from Provincetown, Massachusetts, and her name is Irvin Shavad. Let's hear it for Ever! RBSA! Hello, lesbian and gay America! I am proud to stand before you as a lesbian today! With hearts full of love and with an abiding faith in justice, we have come to Washington to speak to America. We have come to speak the truth of our lives and silence the liars. We have come to challenge the cowardly Congress to end its paralysis and exercise moral leadership. We have come to defend our honor and win our equality. But most of all, we have come in peace and with courage to say, America, this day marks the return from exile of the gay and lesbian people. We are banished no more. We wander the wilderness of despair no more. We are afraid no more. For on this day, with love in our hearts, we have come out. And we have come out to reach out across America to build a bridge of understanding, a bridge of progress, a bridge as solid as steel, a bridge to a land where no one suffers prejudice because of their sexual orientation, their race, their gender, their religion, or their human difference.
That was 1987, October 11th, coming out day. And I'm so proud to know of her and know you and know the connection that you two have. And I believe that the work that you're doing is continuing that work. And that's why I wanted to meet you for that reason.
Again, Alok.
Totally. I really believe that we're an unbroken chain. So much of the work that inspires me is remembering that there was some faggot who did it before me. I just haven't met them yet. And that speech where she says about returning from exile makes a lot of sense, because the truth is we've always been here. We've just been on the margins. And so that's why publications, radio programs like this are so important, to document our legacy and to allow the next generation to know that they're part of an unbroken chain, and to reconnect and connect with their transcestors, with their queer elders. I feel so lucky that I had Orvish in my life, but even before Orvish, there were people doing the same thing. And so it makes me feel, when I'm feeling scared or impossible, or like I lack the courage, I'm like, oh, of course, there were people before me who felt this exact same fear. So I can keep going, because even this fear is not without precedent.
Orvish Evad died of breast cancer on May 14, 2022, and is survived by her longtime partner, Kate Clinton, and Alok.
Here is part of the memorial speech that I gave her. I won't do it all, but I wrote this and I delivered it at her memorial a couple years ago now. Let the poets know that there are some forms of loss that can never be placated. No turn of phrase, no masterclass of a metaphor, no narrative cunning enough to charm away the monstrosity of an untimely death. Instead, we wear it like a family heirloom, clench onto grief like the newest old friend, set an empty seat at every dinner table for the rest of our lives. Our lives, the way that we live them, become the memorial. Once upon a time, I knew a person so beautiful that she had the courage to be herself. An everyday riot. I didn't know that was possible until I met her. I didn't know I was possible until I met her. She had anger more incandescent than the sun. It was only outmatched by her love. Certainly, Orvish was renowned for her forensic diagnosis of every wrong, but what sometimes gets lost is her conviction of what was right about us. We, the degenerate queers, intubated by a culture that tells us that we should precise our disappearing act, call it a personality. Orvish believed that we, the sinners and freaks, that we were beautiful not despite it, but precisely because of it. Or she used to say to me that she was envious of me because I was an artist. She said her brain didn't work that way. I disagreed. That was our love language, disagreement. Orvishi was a visual artist. She developed a self-image of queer people for queer people. She showed us the grandeur of our gender nonconformity, our sexuality, our relationships. She loved all the things we were taught to hate about ourselves, and she did so by making the everyday choice to be free, to not wait for validation or the conferral of legitimacy, but to seize it for herself, freedom, to cultivate it in herself, first like a secret garden, then to share it with all of us when it bloomed too big.
And that brings us to the end of this inspiring two-part journey with Alok Vadmenon, interwoven with the historic voice of their aunt Urvashi Vad from This Way Out's archive. You can find out more about Alok at Alok V. Menon. That's AlokVMenon.com. Alok's art pushes boundaries, creating the more inclusive and beautiful world by challenging the concept of gender binaries. As they continue to tour across North America and Europe, they carry forward their message of beauty, resilience, and inclusivity, inviting us all to embrace a world where freedom knows no bounds. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brian DeShazer for This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Tommy King Perry and Marcos Nara. News Wrap and this week's feature were produced by Brian DeShazer with the assistance of Daniel Huesius. You heard music by Brenton Wood from the TV series Glee and by Koi. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Brad Furr of KGAY in Palm Springs, California, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lisa Trappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on CMHA, Sackville, New Brunswick, KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, Ward, Colorado, WWUH, West Hartford, Connecticut, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Ani, my name is Kaya Mongrain, and this is Put Aside. Trickles of rain upon the canvas roof, gentle wrappings paired with the crackle of flames devouring poplar. The smell of rotting leaves covered in moisture creeps in from the outside. The thermos is set on a crumbling log through the parted canvas, put aside for later. The reminder of July is gone. Having been replaced, having been forgotten, having been. The cold seeps deeply into all that belongs to me. It sinks into my cedar tea in the steel thermos, into the supple moose meat roasting over the stove, into the brown and black fur blankets upon which I lay. I stare up at the beige in a never-ending stretch across the sky. It reminds me I should move. To think of moving is a nearly impossible thought, a thought that